Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Stephanie Domingo.
This is Tux Lurzel.
We come to you from Detroit, Michigan, where we record on land belonging to the Ojibwe, Ottawa, Potawatomi, Wyandot nations that are some of many still very much out here doing their thing, and we'd like to acknowledge that.
That we would.
This is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government. Mm-hmm. We be drinking, we be swearing, y'all.
Fuck yeah. This is, we're drinking a cocktail called the Harvey Wallbanger today.
Yeah.
My story is from the 70s.
Looking forward to trying. I mean, I think I know how it, your face. I think I know how it tastes, but I'm gonna wait for the explanation okay. to try.
So the last time I did a cocktail from the 70s or 80s, I remember talking about how my mom, I had like asked my mom what was popular when she was younger. And she told me
beer
that, well, beer, but she, when I asked like specifically about cocktails, she was like, the only thing I really remember people really drinking a lot of was screwdrivers.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, no, we're not doing that. That's fucking gross.
That's fucking gross.
Yeah. I mean, I drank too many screwdrivers when I was a teenager to ever need to drink them ever again.
Yeah.
So today, the story that I'm going to be telling kind of straddles the 70s and 80s. So when I was looking for a popular cocktail from the 70s, the Harvey Wallbanger just kept coming up again and again everywhere I was looking. And everyone was like, it was the quintessential cocktail of the 70s. Totally ubiquitous everywhere.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Yeah. It's essentially just a gussied up screwdriver. It's a screwdriver.
With some lipstick.
Yeah. Vodka and orange juice with a splash of Galliano, which is a sweet herbal, sort of vanilla herbal flavored liqueur, Italian liqueur. So when I was looking up the history.
It's a me, Galliano.
It's a me. Amazing. So when I was looking up the history of the Harvey Wallbanger, the story that I kept seeing over and over was that there was this bartender, famous bartender named Donato Duke Antone.
Okay.
In the early 1950s, he owned this bar called the Black Watch Bar on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood.
Ooh.
And the story goes that there was a local surfer and bar regular who came in all the time, whose name was Tom Harvey.
Okay.
And one day he came into the bar after losing a surfing competition. He was really upset that he lost this competition. So he asked for his favorite cocktail that Duke would make for him, which was essentially a gussied up screwdriver with Galliano.
Uh-huh.
And he was venting about losing the surfing competition and kind of got really drunk on these drinks and eventually was banging his head on the wall in like frustration that he lost the competition.
Yeah.
Some stories just say that he was like so drunk that he was just walking into wall, like getting banging into the wall.
Yeah.
But either way, Harvey Wallbanger.
Got it.
Is the name. Yeah. Okay. The end. So the cocktail became, this was in the 50s, early 50s. It became more and more popular throughout the 50s. And then in the 60s, a marketing director for a liquor importer wanted to really find a way to push Galliano on American audiences. And he came up with this tagline and this like cartoon for Harvey Wallbanger to go with the cocktail. And by the 70s, it was one of the most popular cocktails in the nation.
Wow.
There are a few problems with this story, though. First of all, anyone who knows anything about LA would know that a surfer from Manhattan Beach is not going to go all the way to Sunset Boulevard for a drink. You're not going to...
It's not the beach?
It's not anywhere near the beach.
Like, oh, okay.
You're going to be spending a long time getting to the bar to have a fucking screwdriver.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's a little suspect.
Okay.
So also, cocktail historians have tried to like find records, written records about this surfer, Tom Harvey, and he didn't really appear to actually exist.
David Wundrich is like, nah.
Yeah, literally David Wundrich was like, nah. But not only that, also this bartender, Antone, supposedly is responsible for a bunch of cocktails. Like he claims to have invented the Rusty Nail, the White Russian, the Kamikaze.
Okay.
Yeah. Another drink called the Freddy Fudpucker, which apparently was big in the 70s too.
What? Wow. Yeah. What a name.
So a lot of people are like, actually, it kind of feels like this guy is just taking credit for cocktails he didn't really invent.
Yeah.
He was quoted a lot in newspapers throughout the 60s and 70s about cocktails that he had claimed to invented. The story goes that he invented this, the Harvey Wallbanger, sometime in the early 1950s. Okay. He never mentions it in the paper until the 70s.
Oh, how convenient.
Yeah.
Okay.
We do know, though, that in addition to owning this Blackwatch bar in Hollywood, he also actually worked for both Galliano and Smirnoff Vodka as a corporate mixologist.
Oh.
Coming up with recipes
for
marketing. We also know that in the late 1960s, this marketing director really was involved in this, worked for Galliano, came up with this cartoon mascot. I'm going to show you a picture.
Oh, front row.
He's like a surfer. He's really like stressed out looking and weird looking. And he had this tagline, Harvey Wallbanger is the name and I can be made, which I guess is like, you can make this drink easily. Okay. Hmm. There were a bunch of cartoons of this guy through this. This is one of them.
It's, oh, weird.
Yeah.
Big feet.
Huge feet.
Yeah.
Some of them, when he's not on the surfboard, he's wearing sandals.
He's made. Okay. This is, I guess it was the 70s.
Yeah.
So drugs.
Yeah. So the most likely real story of what was happening was that there never really was a surfer named Tom Harvey, probably never really existed. It was just a story that was concocted by this marketing team to sell cocktails, sell Galliano.
That seems more likely.
Yeah. This bartender was a corporate mixologist. He either created the drink himself or he stole it from somebody else who created it.
Yeah.
But I mean, he very well could have created it because it's a fucking screwdriver with some Galliano on top.
Yeah. Like,
How hard is that? But either way, no matter where it came from or where the name came from, we do know by the end of the 60s, by like the very tail end of 1969, this cartoon mascot was everywhere.
Hmm.
Like everywhere. There were posters, t-shirts, hats, buttons, mugs, bumper stickers. He was on everything all over the place. And a lot of times he was holding like a little sign that had the recipe for the cocktail on it.
Americans are just very susceptible to marketing.
We sure are, yeah. According to David Wondrich, with this Harvey mascot, quote, to blaze the way, Antone's simple, even dopey drink would go on to be the first drink created by a consultant to actually take the nation by storm.
Okay.
Yeah, and thanks to this ad campaign for the Harvey Wallbanger, Galliano became the number one most imported liqueur to America in the
1970s. What?
Yes.
That's wild.
500,000 cases a year were being imported to the U.S. in the 70s because of Harvey Wallbangers.
I'm shaking my head.
So let's take a little taste, a little cheers here.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
Take it away.
All right. So when I ended last season, the episode that I did to wrap up last season, I talked about Reagan's response or lack of response to the AIDS crisis. And in that episode, I briefly mentioned the moral majority. Reagan was basically afraid to mention anything that even had like a whiff of homosexuality attached to it because of the newfound power of the religious right in the 1980s. Since that episode...
You guys can't hear my face crinkle.
I know. Since we recorded that episode, it's only been a couple of months since that episode aired. We're now living in a whole new level of hell.
It's bad.
Yeah. Since June, the monkeypox epidemic has spread throughout the country almost as quickly as misinformation and confusion about the disease and how it spread. Much like during the AIDS epidemic, Misleading and confusing messaging from the CDC and the federal government have given many people the impression that this disease exclusively affects gay men.
My mom told me that 2 days ago. And I'm like, no, that's not
it's
correct.
It's not true at in all. Any way whatsoever. Yeah. That's not science. How would that be possible?
Thank you.
So now that monkeypox is beginning to spread to other communities, including children, morons like Marjorie Taylor Greene are publicly asking how children are getting an STI, which it is not.
It's not an STI.
But everybody thinks it is because it is often transmitted through sex, but not during sex, but not because of sex.
Yeah, it's any...
It's close contact.
Yeah, if you have cuts.
Exactly. Like well, sheets. Even the pox, like if you're touching somebody's skin for a prolonged period of time and you have it.
Okay, like chicken pox.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she's asking how children are getting an STI from gay men.
Oh!
Yes.
Oh, of course she is.
Mm-hmm. This not so subtle hint at the idea that the LGBTQ community is filled with child molesters and pedophiles and sexual deviants. That. Is nothing new for the GOP and the religious right.
That is their bread and butter. Absolutely. That's red meat.
Yeah. This is also incredibly dangerous and will almost certainly lead to violence against queer people in the same way that Trump's Kung Flu rhetoric led to violence against Asian Americans. And of course, even though we already had a vaccine ready and waiting to be rolled out, the government has basically done nothing to control the spread. Which puts not just gay men, but the entire country in serious danger.
The entire world.
Yeah.
Because we are global.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And we're the only ones not doing shit.
Yeah.
We're the like biggest, richest nation that's not doing dick.
Yeah. We drive the narrative a lot.
Yeah.
People follow. I mean, I don't think anymore people follow early, but it's not a good look.
No, not at all. And it's dangerous to American people. Like, you know, it's not deadly. Not very deadly.
People have died.
But lives people are in like excruciating pain.
Yeah.
And it leaves horrible scars. Like, it's terrible.
Yeah.
And we could stop it very easily with a well-launched vaccine program. But we're kind of just like, here's like a couple vaccines for a couple people. You figure it out.
How many times are we going to have pandemics, endemics that just go around that we could stop?
So easily.
Yeah.
We had this vaccine ready to go. Because it's the same as the smallpox vaccine. It works for...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's what the vaccine is.
Oh, my God.
It's a smallpox vaccine.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. That is... Yeah, that's really... Really disappointing, but I guess not shocking. Because we just have to... We just don't learn from history at all.
At all.
At all. Anyway,
yeah. Yeah. But that's also not the only thing that happened this summer. The Supreme Court also officially overturned Roe v. Wade, for those of you who have been living under a rock.
Under a beautiful rock.
Yes, I wish I could find that rock and live under it with you.
Can I move in?
Yeah. As if that is not dystopian and terrifying enough, they also formed their decision in a way that puts a ton of other rights into question as well. Almost immediately after the decision, Clarence Thomas said that the court should, quote, reconsider... A few other decisions that he and his fellow conservative judges don't agree with, even though they have been law for a long time, much like Roe.
I mean, we are living in a religious state, apparently.
Yes, exactly.
But Sharia law, y'all.
Yeah, I know.
Even though women have rights under Sharia law, but cool.
Yeah.
Muslims bad.
Exactly.
Christian good.
The three cases that he mentioned by name were Griswold, Lawrence, and Obergefell. All cases hinging on our right to privacy, which basically no longer exists since the Roe repeal.
For men and women.
Yes. If you don't know, the Griswold decision gave Americans the right to contraception, which everyone should be fucking pissed about.
Yep.
And Obergefell gave gay couples the right to marry. Both rights are now at serious risk of being revoked, and people are understandably freaking the fuck out.
And people have already been charged with crimes based on, I know there's a lot of people who've been turned in by Facebook friends posting about their periods, and like, it's really scary, and this is only the beginning, guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is just the beginning. It's
really
scary.
But for some reason, people don't really seem to be paying very much attention to the third decision that Thomas mentioned, Lawrence.
Yeah, what is Lawrence?
Lawrence, to me, is the scariest of the three that he brought up.
Oh, Jesus.
basically, it was a decision in Texas that, like, the state tried to arrested a man for having gay sex because it was illegal. Sodomy was illegal.
What year was this?
Not that long ago. I don't know exactly.
Like 80s?
Somewhere in there, maybe okay. 70s, 80s. Yeah. Okay. I don't actually know. Don't quote me on that. But yeah, the Supreme Court was like, you can't do that. Gay sex shouldn't be illegal. But if Lawrence is repealed, states would have the choice whether or not to criminalize sodomy. Yes. Making gay sex a crime. Losing federal recognition of my marriage is certainly terrifying enough. Yeah. It would have horrible consequences when it comes to hospital visitation rights, Social Security benefits, joint property ownership, all of the regular ass married stuff that straight people don't ever have to think about.
Yeah.
Straight people take this stuff for granted, but gay people who had civil unions or whatever, like a state legalized marriage, New York State, when I was married in 2013, it was not federally recognized. I was married in New York State. It was legal here, but I wouldn't receive Social Security benefits, even having a legal marriage in New York State.
Whoa, I didn't know that. Because it's not
federally recognized.
Oh, wow. That's fucked up.
Yeah. Straight people don't think about
that. So they're really trying to criminalize gay sex again?
This is the thing. It's like, that would be horrible to lose my marriage. If it becomes literally illegal to have consensual sexual encounters with people of the same sex, gay people are fucked.
Yeah.
Like, big fucking trouble.
Yeah. Wow.
So I'm bringing, and it, like, the fact that he brought that up as one of the three cases that he was like, we should revisit this.
Yeah. I mean, some other senator was talking about revisiting Loving versus.
But he didn't bring it up because he's married to a white woman.
Yeah. But it's like, if there's no right to privacy, then everything is fair game. Exactly. They can take away everything.
Yeah. But he personally has, he's not, that one is not going to go away because he's not going to vote against it because he's married to a white woman.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Is that enough though? If the rest of them vote?
I don't know. I guess it would be 4-5 rather than 6-3.
Yeah. It would still pass.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Oh, good Lord.
And someone was talking about segregated schools, like rehashing Brown versus the board. Like, what is going to happen? Like, I mean, again, this is worst case scenario, but like, we all really need to be taking note of the power of the Supreme Court. Like, Trump was a fucking piece of shit in every way, but like, he stacked the court and that's going to have ramifications for decades. Okay, let me just let you get into this. I know that it's...
Yeah, this is just my little intro. So I'm bringing all of this stuff up today, not just to wrap up the summer, but also I'm bringing it up because all of these waking nightmares that we've been dealing with all summer long
hinge
on the power of Christian conservatives, the power that Christian conservatives have within our government, the power that they have to force their beliefs on the rest of us and legislate their so-called morality, which is, even though there's a separation of church and state in this country. So as promised at the end of last season, I'm going to be talking about the rise of the moral majority and the reasons behind it today. Okay. A lot of people think that the religious right organized in the early 70s in response to the Roe v. Wade decision from the Supreme Court. The reality is much more racist than that.
I mean, of course, I was just waiting. I'm like, I think it's racist because everything bad is racist. Yes. Like, is the result of white supremacy.
Yes.
It hurts us all. And I don't want people to suffer just to understand how bad white supremacy is. But I feel like we're going to have to suffer to understand, outside of just progressive people. I think people really need to understand that it affects everything
Absolutely.
In this country.
Yeah. Yeah, the reason that the religious right actually organized has much more to do with wanting to keep segregated schools than it did abortions.
Yeah, okay. Yes. That's how you get people.
Yeah. So before we get into it, I would like to propose a toast, a toast. Raise a glass.
Yeah.
Cheers.
To
the separation of church and state.
Yes. I will cheers to that. I will drink to that for the rest of my life because that's how it should be.
Mm-hmm. Not only is the encroachment of Christian morality into federal policy decisions helping to tear our country apart right now, but also, since this country was literally founded on religious freedom, it is fundamentally un-American. What is happening right now? Yeah.
Not according to Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Yeah.
They didn't mean what they said.
And that other, what's her name, Lauren Boebert, basically said that.
Yeah, they're the same thing.
She's like over the separation of church and state.
Yeah, in my mind, they're the same person. Bullshit. But yeah, it's Boebert.
Yeah. So in the 1960s and 70s, I'm just going to dive right in because this is a long story. So in the 1960s and 70s, white Christian conservatives in America basically thought that the sky was falling. Shit was changing. The world was different and they couldn't handle it. Prayer was banned in public schools. There was a sexual revolution. Young people were smoking grass, practicing free love, burning draft cards and bras, and marching against the war in Vietnam.
What? Children were being peaceful and not hurting anyone? Yeah. Oh, no. What's to become of our society?
I know. Black people were marching for and winning civil rights. And gay people were coming out of the closet and winning a few of their own rights. Feminism was having a moment. Women were joining the workforce and giving up traditional roles of housewife and stay-at-home mother. And support was building across the nation for the Equal Rights Amendment. This is by no means an exhaustive list of all of the things that were terrifying old white people in the 70s, 60s and 70s. But suffice it to say, old white people were shitting their fucking pants.
Yeah, they were.
And evangelical and fundamentalist Christians saw these disturbing trends as the sign of social and moral decline of the nation and the possible beginnings of a modern day Gomorrah in America.
Okay. Totally. Yeah.
So in response to this scary changing world that was that Americans were witnessing in this time, we saw the rise of televangelists and megachurches in America.
Yes, yes.
Radio ministries were already really popular before this, but as television... Oh, yeah.
It's like the 18 stuff.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
But as television began to replace radio as the primary form of home entertainment throughout the 60s and 70s, a bunch of televangelists began to make names for themselves. Pat Robertson founded the first all-Christian television channel, the Christian Broadcasting Network, in 1961. And in the following two decades, Oral Roberts, Jimmy Swaggart, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, and Jerry Falwell all became household names. By the end of the 1970s, Jerry Falwell's TV show, The Old Time Gospel Hour, had expanded to appear on 400 different stations across the country.
Yikes.
More stations than Johnny Carson's Tonight Show.
What? Ooh.
Yes. And the congregation at his Thomas Road Baptist Church in Lynchburg, Virginia, had swelled to over 17,000 members.
I like that it's called Lynchburg.
Yeah, I know.
That feels fitting.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's just right.
Yeah.
Again, this simulation is a little too on the nose.
Yeah, this church became the prototype for the modern day megachurch. They were providing childcare, schools, sports leagues, and job training seminars for their members.
Yeah, building community.
Yeah. So you don't have to talk to non-Christian
community.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. However, at this time, Christians largely still stayed out of politics. A lot of Christians saw politics as a dirty game that good Christians should stay away from and not sully themselves with.
Can we go back to that time?
I mean, I wish. Yeah. But unfortunately, in the 70s, that was all about to change. So most people today, if you ask them when the religious right came to power, they would tell you that the moral majority emerged as a political force in the early 1970s in response to Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that evangelicals were so morally outraged by legalized abortion that they decided to band together to overturn it. The movement's leaders often repeat this story. It's a very convenient story for them to use.
Yeah. I always thought it was Johnson and like the fact that he pushed civil rights things that created all of the rifts in the party.
Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of things happening kind of all at once.
Yeah.
But it was post-Johnson. Like, I'm sure that he had a lot to do with, like, the bubblings, beginnings of it.
Or just, like, the switch from, like people
the Southern
supporting.
Strategy. And,
people supporting the Democrats, like, white people supporting Democrats.
Yeah.
They're just like, no, you're going to let black people vote? No.
Yeah.
I'm switching parties.
But it's specifically the religious right that's, like, the key issue here is the idea that, like, religious leaders were encouraging their congregations to involve themselves with politics in a way that they never had before. Yeah. So the movement's leaders like to use that story. In 2005, Jerry Falwell wrote, quote, "I sat there staring at the Roe v. Wade story, growing more and more fearful of the consequences of the Supreme Court's act and wondering why so few voices had been raised against it." And then supposedly he decided then and there that evangelicals needed to organize. Unfortunately for Falwell, the math ain't mathin'.
Oh no, he's lies.
He's lies.
Could you imagine Jerry Falwell being lies?
I mean, a preacher man telling lies? What? In reality, it wasn't until 1979, a full 6 years after Roe, that evangelical leaders seized on abortion as a way to harness political power, the political power of their parishioners. The truth is, when Roe passed, most evangelicals didn't give a single fuck about abortion. They tended to see it as a Catholic issue.
Yes.
And they wanted to stay as far away from that as possible.
I do remember reading stuff about that. Yeah. Like, it was,
They're like, that's none of our business.
I'm not Catholic. Like, why should I be up in arms?
Yeah. In 1968, a symposium sponsored by the Christian Medical Society and an evangelical magazine called Christianity Today refused to characterize abortion as sinful, citing, quote, individual health, family welfare, and social responsibility as justifications for ending a pregnancy.
Oh.
Yes. The evangelical magazine was like, this is, it's fine.
Yeah.
Abortion is totally up to you.
Imagine.
Yeah. In 1971, delegates to a Southern Baptist convention in St. Louis, Missouri, passed a resolution encouraging, quote, Southern Baptists to work for legislation that will allow the possibility of abortion under such conditions as rape, incest, clear evidence of severe fetal deformity, and carefully ascertained evidence of the likelihood of damage to the emotional, mental, or physical health of the mother.
Wow, that sounds like Judaism in Islam.
Yeah.
Those are the exceptions. Like, if it hurts the mother, like, let's, we're done.
It's fine. Yeah. Let's just do it.
Yeah.
The convention reaffirmed this position in 1974, 1 year after Roe passed.
Wow.
And again in 1976.
Oh, shit.
Yes.
Y'all be lying about, wow.
Yeah. But then, for some reason, in 1979, the moral majority formed to exercise the political power of Christian conservatives and make sure President Jimmy Carter would not win a second term.
Hmm.
Which begs the question, why?
Yeah.
Why, though? What changed between, like, 1976 and 1979?
I don't know. What did black people do?
I will tell you what black people did.
Okay.
After this break. We'll be right back.
Wow.
Well, hello there. Do you wish your high school history course had more drinking, more swearing, and more ladies?
Well, do we have the show for you. Her Story on the Rocks is a long-form podcast talking about good women, bad women, fictional women, and non-fictional women from all times and places. Basically, each week we pair two women who we research with a themed signature cocktail. You won't be sorry you listened to our latest episode.
Available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Cheers!
All right, we are back. We didn't need to get new cocktails because we've barely touched these.
We're doing our best.
It's sweet.
It is sweet. It is sweet.
People had such a tolerance for sweet cocktails in
like,
the 70s.
If I had even like another half of this, I would have a headache. Instantly.
Absolutely. It feels like a headache in a glass.
Yeah.
I'm nervous.
Yeah, I've been drinking a lot of water.
Yeah.
In preparation, because I knew that you were making this.
Yeah.
I forget how sweet Galliano is.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I was anticipating it having a more interesting flavor of the Galliano. I was not anticipating how much sweeter it was going to make it. So let's dive back in. So it turns out the whole rise of the moral majority.
What did the blacks do?
Exactly, yeah. It had a lot more to do, or excuse me, it did have a lot to do with a Supreme Court decision.
Oh.
But it wasn't Roe. It actually was about
Loving?
It was about a decision you've probably never heard of before. Green v. Connolly.
No. There's been so many SCOTUS decisions, but I have not. Green v. Connolly?
Yeah.
No.
So I have to rewind back a few decades to sort of set the scene. In 1954, there was another Supreme Court decision, Brown versus Board of Education, in which the Supreme Court said that public schools had to desegregate within 15 years. So after that, instead of doing what they were supposed to do, shitty white racists decided to start founding whites-only private schools instead of sending their kids to public schools where they would be forced to look at black bodies.
Oh, no.
The horror.
The horror. It's really hard to hate people up close.
Yeah.
They would have thought black people were people.
I know. Because most of these private schools that were being founded were being created as Christian academies, they also had the benefit of receiving a tax-exempt status from the government.
Oh.
Yes.
Money, money, money.
Exactly. Yes. Money. And so in the mid-1960s, the schools started forming before desegregation went fully into effect because they were like, we need this set up and ready to go. Yeah. So in the mid-1960s, three such private Christian academies were founded in Holmes County, Mississippi.
Of course.
And then in 1969, just as desegregation was going into effect, a group of black parents from Holmes County, Mississippi, sued the Treasury Department, saying that these new private schools should not be given tax-exempt status because of their discriminatory policies.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
garbage.
That's the law.
Yes. So in January 1970... the court granted a preliminary injunction, which declared these black parents the winners of the case until further review. Later that year, President Nixon ordered the IRS to deny tax exemptions to every segregated school in the U.S., public or private. The following year, the court finally issued their official ruling in Green v. Connolly, which upheld the new IRS policy and said that under the Civil Rights Act, these quote-unquote segregation academies were not, by definition, charitable educational organizations. Therefore, they had no claims to a tax-exempt status.
Yeah. Do what your racist shit, but, like, pay taxes.
Yeah, you can't...
Isn't that, like, just like, do that.
Try and be racist and also make money off of it at the same time. But this new decision that they came up with also, not only would the schools no longer be tax exempt, it also said that donations to these schools would also no longer qualify as tax deductible contributions.
Oh, shit. Whoa.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Religious leaders were furious. Wow,
of course they were.
Furious. Steam coming out of the ears.
Yeah, that's like the worst possible ruling.
Yes.
For their pocketbooks.
Fucking livid.
Yeah.
Like, and they were especially pissed when the IRS started sending questionnaires to church-related private schools, asking them all kinds of questions about their racial admittance policies. Mm. One such school was Jerry Falwell's Lynchburg Christian School. Mm. And Falwell, frankly, didn't see how that was any of their business.
Yeah.
You're the fucking cops? What? You're not here to police us.
Yeah, come on.
Come on.
Come on. Look at me. Look at you. We're the same.
Me. You. Same. So in some states, he complained, it's easier to open a massage parlor than a Christian school.
Do that. friend.
Yes. And then leaders of Bob Jones University, a fundamentalist college in Greenville, South Carolina, boldly told the IRS, we're not going to admit black students. And we shouldn't have to, because the Bible said racial segregation is totally cool. What's your problem? Come on.
Come on. We're one nation under God.
Yeah. Eventually, they did try to admit a small number of black students and put all these
poor black students.
The first one that they admitted, they first did it with one student they admitted.
Oh, no.
And he dropped out like like a month in. He was like, God. Nope. Yeah.
Yeah, poor. It's so bad.
Yeah.
It's really, really bad. I still feel so bad for Ruby Bridges.
Seriously.
And she talks about like just the trauma of it all. And like she has negative feelings about her parents for like forcing her into that. It was bad. Like to have adults spitting on you.
It's disgusting.
And having to like be around like armed guards. She had her own guards.
That's unbelievable. Yeah. So, they tried to admit, like, just a small number of black students and, like, put really heavy restrictions on who could apply. They had to be married men only and, like, could only apply for certain programs. And so the IRS was like, get the fuck out of here. No.
Married men?
Because so that they wouldn't be tempted by the white women in the school.
Oh, for teachers.
No, the black students they admitted had to be married.
Oh, this was college?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was thinking.
Yeah, again. No, this was Bob Jones University.
University, got it. Yeah. Okay.
And the IRS was like, fuck out of here. They rescinded their tax exempt status in 1976. And many evangelical leaders saw this as the last straw.
Yeah.
A conservative Catholic political activist and co-founder of the Heritage Foundation.
Oh, no.
Yes. Named.
Oh, no.
Paul Weyrich. He believed that this could be the beginnings of a conservative political movement. It was actually Weyrich who coined the term moral majority to describe the millions of religious Americans who still cared about traditional Christian family values.
I have a friend, and we're still like, well, I guess we're Instagram friends. He worked for the Heritage Foundation.
What?
Yeah. He worked for them for years, but he like ejected himself from the Republican Party with Trump.
Oh, yeah.
And now he is like a raving Democrat.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to be like, so he's like a Liz Cheney?
No, no. I think it's rare to go so far right to left.
Yeah,
but he was just, turned off by everything.
It's wild that we'll get into this, but like the reasons that the religious right is so into Trump. When he's so
clearly
against their own doctrine and everything, but I'll be talking about that later.
Okay. I'm going to shut up.
No, please. I mean, don't shut up.
Okay.
Yeah. Don't you dare. But yeah, it was actually,
open your wet mouth.
So several years into Jimmy Carter's term as president, Weyrich, Falwell, and other religious leaders blamed Carter for the IRS's actions against segregated schools, despite the pesky, inconvenient facts that Nixon put the policy into place at the IRS, and Bob Jones University lost their tax exemption a year before Carter was inaugurated.
But Carter's a Democrat.
Exactly.
So
that is exactly it. It didn't
Democrats
matter.
Democrats care about black people, so
100%. Yeah. That's all it was. They had to take Carter down. He had nothing to do with what their problem was, but they had to take him down because he was a Democrat.
Yeah.
Yeah. They knew that if they wanted to keep schools segregated, a Democrat was not going to help them do that.
And keep their tax exemption.
Exactly. Yeah. And always aware of image and branding, Jerry Falwell began to realize that coming out vocally and publicly in support of segregation might not be a cute look for Christian conservatives in the 1970s.
Yeah.
I mean, that might have worked for
certain
Christian leaders,
like
the leaders of the church who were in charge of getting these tax-deductible schools together. But the congregations were not going to buy that. They're not.
I mean,
gonna,
I feel like
some of
them
would, but a lot of them would have balked
at it. In the South.
Yeah. They were trying to get a bigger audience, basically.
Yeah.
So, like, we need to find a way to mobilize evangelical voters on a large scale. So we need to find a different issue and, like, talk about
something else.
It has to be something else. We're going to – we care about one thing. We're going to pretend we care about something else.
Oh, my God. The Republican Party is so good.
Yes. Yeah. Luckily for them, by the late 1970s, many Americans, not just Roman Catholics – were beginning to feel uneasy about the unexpectedly high numbers of legalized abortions that were being performed every year. I don't know what the fuck they thought was going to happen.
I mean, are they really looking at the numbers like that?
They were, and they were a lot higher than people expected them to be.
So what?
Yeah. Well, exactly. It's none of your fucking business what people are doing.
It's better, you know? The higher, the better. Like, people are getting rid of pregnancies that they don't want. Like, that's good for everyone.
It's, like, good for society. It doesn't make fucking sense.
Yeah.
It's only bad for rich people. Like, it doesn't... It don't make no sense.
Don't make no sense. Yeah. Seriously. Like, it's... Yeah. Anyways.
But, yeah, for...
It's trash.
Just as I thought.
Just as I thought.
Trash. Either way, no matter what the reasons or whatever the fuck they thought was going to happen, Roman Catholics and other pro-life activists started putting a ton of money and energy into spreading anti-abortion propaganda in the late 70s.
Okay.
They framed the procedure as murder and suggested that the next step of the liberals would be legal infanticide.
Whatever.
Which they're still saying this shit today, 50 years later.
They're still saying, calling things heartbeat bills.
Yeah.
At 6 weeks, there's no heartbeat.
It's
It is cardiac cells.
Yeah.
There's no beat.
It don't make no sense.
Yeah. It's not science.
Yeah.
It's lies.
But these theatrics and scare tactics worked to start swaying public opinion towards the beliefs of these, like, few rogue pro-life activists and Roman Catholics that were really concerned about the death of the fetus.
Care for that fetus.
Yeah. So then, thanks to all of this anti-abortion propaganda, several really, really unlikely pro-life Republicans were suddenly elected to higher office in 1978. These people were people who didn't have a shot in hell, but all of these pro-life candidates won Senate races, governor races, mostly in the Midwest. It had a lot to do with all of this anti-abortion propaganda that the Roman Catholics were putting out and these few rogue pro-life activists. This guy, Weyrich, called the triumph of all of these pro-life candidates, quote, a true cause for celebration, because it demonstrated that abortion might now motivate conservatives in a way that it never had in the past. So while Weyrich had come up with the idea for the moral majority, it was Jerry Falwell who had the media following and the influence and the charisma, uniqueness, nerve, and talent.
No. How dare you?
to pull off this whole idea.
RuPaul would be so upset by that association.
Yes. So the moral majority was officially founded in 1979, and with Jerry Falwell as their leader.
Wow, so late. Wow.
Roe was 73.
Yeah.
Fully 6 years after.
Wow. I bought the lie.
Yeah. And yeah, they quickly became a nationwide political movement with Jerry Falwell at the head as the charismatic
leader.
Yeah. Mm. When asked why he wanted to get Christians involved in politics, Falwell said, quote, "We're not trying to jam our moral philosophy down the throats of others. We're simply trying to keep others from jamming their amoral philosophies down our throats."
Fuck it.
Literally. Fuck out of here. Asshole. Like, nobody's jamming nothing down no one's throat. We're talking about segregated schools here, and you're pissed because you're not getting a tax break anymore.
Ugh.
So to win over non-religious voters and social conservatives, the moral majority started to carefully develop language that would appeal to an ever broader constituency.
Mm. Yes.
Rather than speaking out directly against abortion activists or gays or feminists, they started shrouding their messaging in pro-family terms.
Yes, yes.
And they also came up with this rhetoric that painted liberal and progressive reformers as enemies of the family.
He's still alive. You want to kill
babies.
He is still alive and kicking. Ugh. Oh, wait, no. What was...
Are you thinking Pat Robertson?
You know.
This is the second time that you've done that.
In my mind, they're the same person, but yeah, okay.
They're both very famous, charismatic televangelists. And Pat Robertson was horrible in his own way, but he was not.
He's the one who looks like a goblin.
Well, no, yeah. But he was not the one that founded the moral majority. He was not the brainchild behind the birth of the religious right.
Yeah.
So as the 1980 election moved closer and closer, the moral majority sprang into action. mobilizing politicians and religious leaders to help support their platform. They boasted a political war chest worth millions of dollars. And by the summer of 1980, they had opened offices in Washington, D.C.
Damn.
And in just 1 year, they gained over 83,000 new addresses for their mailing list.
Wow.
They also sponsored, that summer, they sponsored a meeting of 15,000 conservative pastors to teach them how to get their congregations to the polls, to vote for pro-morality and pro-family candidates.
It's a little workshop.
Exactly. With 15,000 pastors. They called it the religious roundtable. And taking a page out of the playbooks of union leaders and civil rights activists, the Moral Majority began a national voter registration drive.
Yeah.
Informed potential voters of morality ratings of each candidate. Formed moral action committees in churches.
Wow, it's their SNCC.
Yeah, totally.
But like hateful.
Yeah. Used telephone banks to contact voters.
Wow, they and are provided using, like,
transportation to the polls.
Oh my God, of course.
Yes.
The civil rights playbook.
Exactly.
That's how you get change.
Yeah. Yeah, at some point, I took this out of my outline, but Jerry Falwell said something. I can't remember the exact quote. I had a quote, I took it out, but something about how, like, the blacks were doing it, and now we're going to do it. Like, the blacks. Fuck you, dude.
Trump says the blacks.
What a world.
What a world. It's like, I think if we learn real history, things can change.
Yeah.
But the fact that, like, we just keep replaying history, like, different versions of the same fucking shit.
Well, that's kind of why I wanted to tell this story, is because, like, people don't know where the religious right came from or why.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with what they tell you that it had something to do with.
I question everything, and I'm just like, this feels wrong and, like, possibly racist. And, like, usually I'm right, and I don't even know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And I'm just like, this feels off in a way that's familiar.
Yeah, totally.
And the fact that it's so deeply embedded, to me, just always points to racism.
I mean, like, just being anti-abortion is also racist in its own right.
Yes, it is. Very racist.
But this is so much more racist than it was. Like, literally, they wanted to protect segregated private whites-only schools.
Wow.
So less than 3 months before the election of 1980... the Moral Majority officially threw their support behind Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
Although Reagan was not the perfect conservative in their eyes, he was twice married.
Sounds familiar.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Alienated from his children.
Oh.
Almost never attended church.
Oh, carried a Bible upside down.
very familiar.
For a photo op.
They still insisted that he was much better than Carter as an option, even though Jimmy Carter was a Southern evangelical Christian.
Wow.
Just like them. And he had actually tried to reduce the number of abortions that American women sought throughout his term as governor and as president. But they were like, no, he's not. He's a Democrat.
Yeah.
We can't do this. And despite the fact that in California in 1967, Ronald Reagan had signed the most liberal abortion bill in the country into law.
Oh my God.
They're like, nope, Reagan's our dude. It don't make no fucking sense.
What?
You can't make sense out of nonsense.
Wow. The most liberal. And they're like, he's our dude. Mm-hmm. He's going to do it.
Carter's a Democrat.
He has an R next to his name.
Yeah. Years after the civil rights movement, segregated schools were the real name of the game here. And they knew that Carter was not their man.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, as we all know, in 1980, Carter lost the election. And Jerry Falwell quickly lined up to claim credit, often quoting a Harris poll that suggested that Carter would have won the popular vote by a margin of 1% had it not been for the religious right. Some say that it's actually really hard to quantify just how much influence the right really had.
Also, 1% is nothing.
Especially with the popular vote.
Yeah, that's 1% is literally nothing.
Yeah, but either way, Carter was up against an energy crisis, an inflation crisis,
bad timing,
and a hostage crisis all at once. Ooh. So it was bad news.
Yeah.
It's very possible that he didn't stand a chance either way. But whether the Moral Majority swayed the election or not, politics was never the same again, ever again.
Yeah, I mean, if you just say it enough, it becomes true.
Exactly.
Like, people believe it because we don't have real journalism in this country.
Yeah, Jerry Falwell is, like, one of the first people that were invited to the White House by the Reagan.
Yeah.
Like, and Reagan didn't really do everything that the moral majority wanted them to do. He never went after abortion. He never reinstated school prayer.
It doesn't matter. He's a Republican. Exactly. That's, like, all that he needed.
Yeah. But he knew that Reagan knew that the religious right was now this, like, powerful new political presence that he had to be worried about. He had to keep them happy or else. Mm-hmm. I already talked about how that shaped his response to the AIDS crisis. But because of Jerry Falwell and the moral majority, Reagan also put several powerful evangelicals and fundamentalists into cabinet appointments.
Very
important cabinet appointments, laying the foundation for the ever-expanding influence of religious conservatives.
Yeah. Did you put anyone government? On the court?
Sandra Day O'Connor.
Sandra Day.
But she wasn't all that. She wasn't.
But also Rehnquist.
Oh.
It was kind of middle ground.
But yeah, Scalia, I feel like he didn't.
Kennedy.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So he put four different people.
Well, it's because he had the two terms.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So he did Scalia in his second term. Rehnquist, Scalia, and Kennedy.
And Sandra Day O'Connor.
Wow. That sucks.
Absolutely does.
Wow. He did Scalia. Of course he fucking did.
Yeah.
Trash.
So the legacy of the moral majority and the religious right and the rhetoric that they used back in the late 1970s and early 1980s still haunts us to this day. Mm. They're here to stay. We can't.
Yeah, they are the narrative.
Yeah. And they weren't even really around for all that long. After 8 years of Reagan being in power, many Christians no longer saw the nation as this supposed moral peril that they saw before. And donations to the moral majority dried up. They were on a steady decline throughout the 80s.
Okay.
By 1989, after only 10 years, Jerry Falwell officially disbanded the moral majority, saying, quote, "Our goal has been achieved. Mm. The religious right is solidly in place. And religious conservatives in America are now in for the duration."
He was right.
He was absolutely right. Yeah, the religious right was now solidly in place. The moral majority was no longer even necessary. It was redundant by this point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the story of the founding of the moral majority and the way the religious right came to power.
Yeah, that was awful. I mean, thank you.
Yeah. So in Trump, I think the religious right thought that they had found another Reagan. He's
like their imperfect vessel.
I was just about to say it. He's an imperfect vessel with flaws that went against their doctrine. Mm-hmm. But he's also an image-obsessed celebrity who would be too scared of being unpopular to go against their policies and priorities.
Yeah.
And unlike Reagan, Trump didn't actually know dick about politics and didn't really have his own priority, which Reagan did.
Was just winning. His priority is winning.
Exactly.
And not being imprisoned for his crimes.
Right. My God.
Sorry. Too real.
So without a real agenda of his own, they knew that they would be able to mold him to their will. And as we know, he filled his cabinet and the courts with religious extremists.
Yeah.
It was
such extremists too.
Yeah.
Like really scary extremists.
Literal
extremists,
religious extremists. So it's like, you know, it's 2022. It's too late to resegregate schools. Although one could certainly argue that his appointment of Betsy DeVos and her focus on charter schools.
Yeah. It's coming.
Yeah. Certainly it's another coming. Attempt.
Yeah.
But either way, 49 years after Roe, the moral majority got their wish. Roe v. Wade has been struck down. Ta-da!
Yeah, they were playing that long game.
Yeah. 50 fucking years.
And like their consistency, like that's the left, especially the progressive left, like just is not winning on messages like at all.
No.
There's no consistency and it's just very reactionary. They don't have this one thing that they're really pushing for. They say a lot of things, but they don't actually build the community that the religious right did.
Because there's so much infighting and people have such different opinions about how things should go.
Yeah.
And I feel like if we were able to focus on one message or focus on like getting religion out of politics because there's a fucking separation of church and state in this
unifying,
country.
Yeah. I mean, it should be unifying.
If the fact that it worked for them to say, like, we don't want other people's opinions jammed down our throat. Like, hello, same here.
Yeah.
Y'all call yourselves the moral majority, but you're not the majority.
No.
Not by a long shot.
No, not even close.
Nobody wanted Roe repealed.
No. It's really scary that they were able to push that through. But that was their mission and they were consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And like people just get worn down over time with you say the same message. Like they just... And these people, they go out to vote every time because, again, they have these pastors who are saying like, hey, there's a primary right now. Like, go vote for the hateful one.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's God's will.
I mean, it really only happened because Trump was able to put so many people on the Supreme Court because of fucking Mitch McConnell being...
Yeah. All turkey neck.
Yeah. But...
I hate everything.
I hate Same.
Everything.
Welcome back for season 5.
Yeah, thank you.
I hate everything.
I mean, your scandal was very reality-based.
Yes.
Whereas mine was fanciful.
Yes, yours was very fanciful. And I needed it after researching this story.
Yeah.
There was a lot more that I could have dug into. I cut a lot from this story just because I'm like, I can't get in the doldrums in this way, but like you get the gist of it.
Absolutely. Like, and I think it's so clarifying.
Yeah.
Especially I think a lot of people think that it was a reaction to Roe.
They didn't give a
fuck. Yeah.
Not a single fucking fuck. Wow. In fact, they were out here saying exactly the opposite, saying what all of these like liberal extremists are saying today, that like,
how dare you use their words?
Yeah.
To break down their current position now.
Oh my God. Exceptions for rape and incest and all that? Like, that's malarkey. That's
the devil.
Yeah. But y'all were literally saying that. Years after Roe passed, y'all were saying this.
They're like, I'm not me.
I wasn't me.
I wasn't me.
Madness.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's my story.
Yeah, that was really good. Thank you.
The worst.
No, it was necessary. And I think it's good because people need to know this.
Facts are facts, America.
People need to be aware of just like, the reality of these movements that have gotten so popular and have been popular for a really long time and are currently dictating our religious state.
Like, y'all are following a false prophet. These people were literally trying to do this because they didn't want their kids to have to go to school with black people. That's what this all is about.
It's such trash that that's what it's all about. But also, it's so obvious now, knowing what I know.
Yeah.
And like, this is consistent.
Yeah.
Like, it's always about racism at its core.
Yeah.
Sadly.
Yeah. Racism and tax scams.
Yeah. Capitalism and racism.
Yeah.
Like,
hand in hand.
Hand in hand, always.
Yes. It's an infinity loop.
Yeah.
Racism and capitalism.
Oh my God.
And capitalism.
Oh my God. That needs to be a graphic.
Yeah.
Okay. We need to make that happen if it doesn't already exist.
Yeah.
Because it is true.
Yeah.
But yeah, our drinks are not empty.
Nearing empty hood.
They're like empty hood. They're like 3/4 of the way finished. We're getting there.
I'm proud of myself
Same.
For getting there.
I am doing my best, y'all. I'm doing my best.
Get off my back,
Thank
Susan.
You.
Susan.
Thank you. It's so funny that I always, I just want to say Jason.
I thought you were going to say Deborah.
Oh, yeah. No.
But also Jason, yes.
I was just thinking of
Jason.
Exactly, yeah. The step dad voice. But yeah, our drinks are almost empty, you know. So we're done. America's history is juicy. We just add vodka, orange juice, and some Galliano.
Ooh, ooh la la. Italian,
even. Italian. We're European. Try to be us. Get on our level.
We love Europe.
Yerp. So thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lurzel.
Thank you to our new audio editor, Dev. We could not do this without him.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Couldn't happen.
Nope. Would never. We could never.
We could never. All right, guys.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Beyond Reproach. Please note we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. A full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a written review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media and make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop on beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We also have exclusive content on Patreon where you can directly support the production of our show.